A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail? Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Kudos Hindenburg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today's guest is Tessa Hadley. You know, there are so many British writers that I'd like to have on the show, but it's a fairly rare occurrence that you make your way around America. I'm grateful to...
Well, I'm feeling very lucky to be here.
Thank you. The past is a fascinatingly shaped book, and I think it's built around a shock to expectation. So the very first sentence reads, Alice was the first to arrive, but she discovered as she stood at the front door that she had forgotten her key. Mm. We're there, but we don't get to go in. And again, this kind of thing happens in the book. They've come to a house in, is it Somerset?
Yes, it is.
Where they've spent many summers. The house belonged to their grandparents, and it's a place where many joys, but many sorrows too, have occurred. And I think this forgetting the key that you begin with stands in for their desire to forget so many other things that have happened there. Mm-hmm. They're always busily remembering and forgetting. Now, we've got four siblings.
Four siblings in their middle age. The oldest one is Harriet, and she's 50. And she, in a way, is... she was perhaps the richest character for me to write, partly because she isn't rich. She's a little inhibited.
She's austere.
She's punishing herself. We learned that she had a past as a very active revolutionary. She laid down in front of cruise missiles and went to jail. And then, in some terrible loss, lost her belief, her revolutionary conviction, and has never quite replaced that with anything else.
And she hasn't married. Mm. And her siblings all have. Some of them have children. Mm. And, you know, there's a strange feeling that the woman who... It's not that she regards herself as a spinster aunt, but she fears that others regard her that way. And she has a sister, Alice, who's the most sprightly and romantic of the bunch, and exactly the one who will misplace the key.
Yes.
She does it over and over again. Yes. That's her life. And an older brother?
Roland is the second child, yes, who's sort of having been swamped by girls, I think, in his childhood. He's liberated himself to become powerful as a man in that way that men do, and he's the intellectual of the family.
He's very elegant. Mm. His clothes are now elegant. Mm. His sisters find it rather amusing, the colognes he has and the, you know, beauty products that he uses. Mm. He's been married three times, and along with him is his new wife, Pilar, and his daughter from his first marriage, named Molly, who is now
16.
And there's one other. She's the youngest, and she's had it, in a sense, the easiest because she's the most efficient.
Yeah.
Her name is Fran. She has two children, Arthur and...
Ivy.
Ivy initiates a secret cult in an abandoned cabin. She and her little brother find pictures from pornographic, old pornographic magazines, waterlogged and moist. And she tells her younger brother stories about these women, that they're goddesses of sorts, and they demand sacrifices and forms of worship. And these things are part of the female mythology of this novel, The Past.
Yes.
The punishing, beautiful woman.
Yes.
The woman that most women don't become, who becomes, well, frightening.
Yes.
Intimidating.
I realized what an awful lot I'd written in this book. I don't think it's a perpetual theme of mine, but I've written so much about looks and dress and performance of self. And obviously that somewhere was just obsessing me while I wrote this. And in fact, it's interesting about Alice and Harriet. That's Harriet, who's austere and spinsterish, and Alice, who's sort of gorgeous. But I say somewhere, they actually look very alike. These are choices or performances rather than destinies.
And what brings them all together is this house, which has become a vacation house, a holiday house, a summer house. No one lives there. It was once rather beautiful, but it's becoming decayed and somewhat decrepit, in need of more repairs than any of these four siblings can afford.
Yeah.
And they're coming there to decide whether to sell the house. One of them actively doesn't want to. Do any of them really want to?
Well, Fran, the youngest, because she's efficient, as you said, and she's a maths teacher, and she sort of refuses to some extent the messy emotionalism of her family, or tries to refuse it. She keeps insisting that she would like the money from the house, although who knows, it's not going to be that much anyway between four of them. But I mean, who knows whether she isn't just performing that role as well. In a way, no, it's funny. I think you're right. It feels like a destiny that this house needs to stop being the emotional center of all their lives. And almost historically, that the role of the lovely old crumbling rectory and the old bourgeois English family, that it's time to draw a line under that somehow.
Yes. And yet, for many years, they've met and discussed possible renovations or plans. They've presented cases to one another. But the past comes to us, it haunts us, and then it stays with us.
Yes.
So I'm not sure at the end of this book that they'll ever be able to part with the house, that this story will continue with variation for several more generations.
I love that thought. I love the thought that they might put it on the market and then just nobody's that interested and it just drifts on and there's another year and another. I really like that.
But this house then becomes the place that Alice has retreated to. She's retreated from life. She doesn't know how to move around, and she's even looking at properties that are entirely inappropriate, that don't have running water, that don't have indoor plumbing. And in fact, because she's so starved for affection, she has a bit of a flirtation with the agent who's showing the houses. And we learn by the end of the book that he too, he hasn't been married. He hasn't figured out how to live. And he, too, has loved Alice forever, But like many of the characters in the book, he's never been able to say so.
Yes.
Was that
yes.
an initial theme? People who could not speak their desires and
yes.
who couldn't figure
yes.
out life.
Yes, who couldn't. But not as if it's a diagnosis against a normal. More as if that's a little bit the condition of stuff. None of them find some kind of solid, simple key to the door of fulfillment. But they are all fully alive, even in their partialness, even the fact that, you know, Harriet hasn't been very good at passion. There's something withdrawn in her, and her sister Alice has, you know, made a mess of a succession of relationships and so on. But that's life. That's normal.
But like many people, these characters still believe that a wonderful change is awaiting them,
yes.
is possible
yes.
for them. And in the section we're going to hear, Tessa Hadley, my guest and the author of The Past, allows the sister who's sort of naturally beautiful, Alice, to show Harriet what she might do with herself to be a bit more comfortable in the world. I wouldn't say, well, yes, pretty. This is Alice and Harriet.
Alice went inside to brush her hair before supper. She remembered, as she always did, that her mother had sat at this same dressing table, first as a girl, and then again later when the children spent their summers here with her and their father went off painting. Slanting late sunlight glinted on Alice's bottles of scent and makeup and nail varnish, the lustre jug with its posy, gold threads in a scarf, the heap of her jewellery, none of it valuable, but each piece striking and interesting, rich with sentimental associations. Wherever Alice settled, she had this gift of applying little touches to make the place distinctive and attractive, as if she were composing a scene for a play. She had moved from one room or flat to another very often in London, transforming each one in turn into a nest full of curiosities and nice things. Looking in the mirror now, she held her brush suspended in the air, staring over her reflection's shoulder to the reflected room behind. Quietly, she breathed aloud, "My dear," although she didn't know who she was speaking to. Her fine hair crackled with static, floating up towards the brush. Breaking her mood, Harriet was suddenly present, blocking the reflected space in the mirror, intruding on her reverie. Of course, it wasn't Harriet's fault that she had come through Alice's room, but she crept about so quietly. Because Alice was startled, she couldn't help being annoyed. Harriet made her feel caught out in vanity. She dropped her hairbrush and twisted round from the mirror. "Goodness, are you spying?" "I thought I ought to tell you," Harriet said gruffly, "that I've arranged with work to take more holidays, so I will be able to stay here longer after all." Guilty, Alice was aware of overacting her delight. She jumped up from the dressing table stool to kiss her sister, feeling how Harriet stood stiffly in her embrace, not knowing how to yield to it. "Oh, Hetty, I'm so pleased. Thank you," she exclaimed. "And I know I don't deserve you doing anything nice for me. I'm a grumpy old stick. I'm sorry." "I didn't do it for you," Harriet said. "It's good for me to have a break. I'm enjoying myself." She didn't much look like it, Alice thought. She looked strained, and there were purple stains on the fine skin under her eyes as if she hadn't slept. Alice hoped this wasn't because she'd been put in that awkward, pokey bedroom. She had some clever concealer which would work wonders with those under eyes, but she was wary of offering it, thinking Harriet would only despise her. Harriet prodded around among the bottles on the dressing table. "I've never gone in for any of this clobber," she said. "What is it all?" Alice was watching her closely. Look, she said, sit down on the stool. Let me try something on you. Just the least little thing. It's only the teeniest smudge of cream. No one will notice. You'll just look prettier. Harriet's expression as she hesitated brimmed uncharacteristically full with mixed reluctance and yearning. She gave way and sat submissively with her back to the mirror. Alice rummaged in her makeup bag and then, very carefully, tenderly, stroked on the concealer. And after that, a very light foundation, eye pencil, eyeshadow, mascara. Their two faces, for once, drew uninhibitedly close without any antagonism. Harriet's vulnerably proffered, Alice absorbed in what she knew supremely well. Oh, no, Harriet said with horror when finally she looked at her reflection. It isn't me. It isn't right. Take it off, Alice.
Tessa Hadley reading from her novel, The Past, and I'm Michael Silverblatt. You're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We'll continue after this short break.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Tessa Hadley about her book, The Past, about a family reunion that reveals how the past has a paralyzing grip on the present. Now, this is a very British novel. It's about the inheritance of the house. It's been said that that's one of the major subjects of the Victorian novel. And here, it's very interesting because these characters simultaneously have deep feelings about the house, but they've never communicated them to one another. Nothing can work out as it's intended, and Alice wants to be the boss of it all, but she's so frivolous that she can't enforce her desires. So what we're watching, in a sense, is simultaneously a character portrait of a family and a comedy of their misadventures in healing themselves to know one another.
But again, I think I'm loving the comedy and believing that so much of family life is comical in just this imperfect way, rather than suggesting there's some normalizing better way they could be. I can't. They're a wonderfully successful family, in a sense. When it comes down to it, they are marvelously kind, deeply to one another, and I'm not sure one can ask much more than that. And they're imaginative about one another. They make all those, there's all that clumsiness of the bit I just read. What is Alice doing trying to turn Harriet into herself? And yet the clumsiness is offered out of kindness, and Harriet is submitting. For a moment, their two very different worlds feel permeable. They come close, their faces so close to each other. But we're all human beings, and then that moment can't be sustained for very long.
Yes, and over again in this novel, there's the looking in a mirror at what's behind. Is that an aspect of the past? It's encroachment, because it struck me that a lot of mirror viewing was going on in this book.
I was really conscious of that. I mean, I didn't want it to be a sort of heavily drummed in metaphor, but I actually had my moments of almost wanting, when I was searching for a title, I was looking around Alice and the Looking Glass, and then I thought, oh, but I can't have a character called Alice, and she's got to be called Alice, and I'm glad I didn't do that, but definitely the initial scene, as you say, Alice has forgotten her key. She's there with this young man who is her ex-boyfriend's son, and they're wandering around the outside of the house, peering in at it. That felt to me the right way to begin the whole novel. And then they keep catching glimpses of themselves in mirrors. And that's what happens. I mean, a house is a metaphor before you even start work. It's saturated with the scenes that have taken place in those rooms, the dead missing people who once lived in those spaces, and your own past selves acting out your lives in those spaces. So I was fascinated by the sense of all the layers. And when they look in the mirror, it's as if they can glimpse other layers of their own presence in these same spaces.
Yes, what fascinated me about those layers is that down a ways, there's that abandoned house without plumbing, without water. How do these pornographic pictures... Who did they belong to? The farmer who lived there was said to be religious and austere. And so this little cabin really means something to each of the people who enter it.
Yes.
To the little children, it's a haunted space, a space of...
Yes, appalling initiations, really, but necessary initiations.
Yes,
because, I mean, I was very aware... how the setup of these middle-aged siblings gathering in this country house is archetypal. It's got a classic feel to it. And I was very aware of deploying something that's a lovely tradition in literature, and equally to then create another space, which is sort of outside civilization, where really dangerous stuff happens. And I didn't just supply pornography, sex in that dangerous, wild place. I also put in death. There's also a dead dog.
Yes.
The children have both initiations, both at once, the pornography in one room and then in the inner chamber, death.
I wondered, in a word, now this is tricky because the book keeps rotating, you know, but what do you think, what is the book about? Family, time, loss, if you had to choose one?
If I had to choose one. Oh, no. Can't it be about family and time? Maybe it's about time, but who's interested in time when it isn't embodied in family? I mean, yes.
Well, it's really about all three.
Yes,
but
yes.
One of the things that's interesting, the book keeps feeling as if it's on the verge of a revelation that no one in this family, this net of people, knows how to bring on. Even when they finally sit down to their family conference, the hovering sense that there is a revelation.
Well, particularly Alice has that. She keeps having these moments. I mean, she's the intuitive and vaguely spiritual one. But that's real. She keeps having these moments when in the house she has the intimation that round the corner, in the movement of light against the wallpaper, something is about to be given to her, some new experience. She only finds out right at the end what that new adventure of hers is going to be. But I feel that the truth is that they are in the revelation all the time. They don't have it in a known way that they can take hold of and articulate. They are embodying it, actually. I mean, I don't really believe in any transcendent truth that lies behind all these appearances and interactions of warm, flawed human beings. They are making the revelation in ways that they can't know about themselves, but the book tries to know about them as they do it.
Tessa Hadley has become one of the writers who appear really regularly in The New Yorker. And I read a story, Dido's Lament.
It was my last one.
It was very recent, and I thought it was very, very fine. But it, too, winds around that sense of loss. I wondered, when you consider how detailed and full-blown the novel, The Past, is, do short stories seem like hors d'oeuvres to you?
No, they don't ever. I always think the story is as full in its scale. If a story works, it's as full in its scale as a novel is. And I, of course, I'm so wholly convinced by those marvelous writers we have who only ever wrote stories, Lucia Berlin or Mavis Gallant or Alice Munro. I completely understand.
Grace Paley.
Yes, Grace Paley, yes. So I don't quite know what it is that makes me want to do both. I love the singleness and the kind of inward tightness of a story, but there's something for me that I also like the long speculative span of a novel, which can take its exploration in so many different directions.
Well, you really took me on quite a journey. The sense of a suspended resolution was nearly constant in this book, no matter what perspective is shown. There's always a new perspective. I did think a lot about Howard's End when reading this book somehow, the E.M. Foster novel. I love this book because it is such a annunciation of where the British novel, in all of its traditions, is now. The house, the inheritance, the extended family, the sisters, the jealousies, the comparisons. It's a summation of what the British novel is. Try reading The Past. It's published by Harper Perennial, and it's just come out in paperback by our guest, Tessa Hadley. Thank you for joining us.
It's been lovely to talk to you.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Past at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. You know, I love this kind of novel because even talking about it, I feel like we've been gossiping about the characters in exactly the way they gossip about one another.
Yeah.
It's been great fun. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when T.C. Boyle is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.